Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Seeking Justice Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Denny Griffin, and for the next 60 minutes, my co-host Kim Colton and I will be talking with our guest on this special edition. Kim, welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Denny, for having me, and it'll be another wonderful night here. I want to start out by saying, so I don't forget, because I always forget this, we get into the show before I say this, is if you want your case profiled, please email myself at kim@crimeandmystery.com or Denny Griffin at griff1945@hotmail.com. And, of course, during the show, we would love to hear from our listeners. You can call us at 646-478-0982. And that's all I wanted to say.
Well said, Kim. Well said.
Thank you.
And the reason we refer to the show as a special edition is that we're not profiling a specific case tonight. And I want to introduce our guest for this evening, or I should say welcome back our guest for this evening, Mr. Dwayne T. Bowers. And Dwayne was on with us a couple of weeks ago. He is a traumatic loss therapist and educator in private practice. He's authored the books Guiding Your Family Through Loss and Grief and A Child is Missing, Providing Support for Families of Missing Children. Dwayne teaches seminars nationally and internationally and regionally on dying, death, and grief, as well as trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, and traumatic loss. His specialty is working with survivors of traumatic death and suicide, which includes assisting families who must identify loved ones at the D.C. Office of the Chief Medical Examiner through the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing. He also provides support to families of abducted, missing, exploited, murdered children through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Dwayne, welcome back.
Thank you, Denny. Thank you. Hi, Kim. How are you?
Hi, Dwayne. I'm just fine, and thank you for coming back.
Thank you. I enjoyed my first visit with you, and I look forward to this one. Thank you for inviting me again.
Dwayne, what I wanted to start out with tonight is we touched on this, I believe, very, very briefly the last time you were on, was intervention immediately after an event and a debriefing. And I believe, as luck would have it, you just gave a talk on this yesterday in Oswego County, New York, not far from where I am. So would you mind discussing what we're talking about when we say immediate intervention or intervention immediately after an event?
Certainly.
And a debriefing and controversy.
Absolutely. Immediately after a traumatic event, that would be a disaster or even a more traumatic one, such as a homicide, even suicide, accident, whatever. Immediately after an event, there has been controversy about how should you, if you only have one shot at the victim, in other words, you only have a few minutes, you only have one time to meet with the victim, what is the best thing you can do for that victim immediately after the event that will help them as far as a mental health perspective? For years now, we have been using what's known as debriefing. And actually, I'm going to take just a minute to give a little history on debriefing. Debriefing actually came out of World War II, where a commanding officer had runners come tell him what was going on the front. And what he found out was each runner had a little bit different perspective on what they saw. But when those runners heard each other's stories and they got to talk to each other about the differences and what they saw and whatever, they realized they were feeling better and they were feeling more confident to go back out onto the front. That became debriefing, and it was used in the Korean War and also in the Vietnam War as a way to help military personnel in the field, on the line, deal with the trauma and the experience of being on the line while they were out there. Well, out of that, we developed what we call now debriefing, and there have been many models of it. I think probably the most famous is CISM. It's the Critical Incident Stress Management Model, developed by a person named Mitchell, who's actually here up in Baltimore, Maryland. And it was developed for frontline responders. It was developed for fire folk, police folk, you know, people who are not only in traumatic events but are expected to go back into traumatic events. Well, eventually, they started developing this debriefing to be used for victims of the event or survivors of the event. And it was popular for many years, but more and more research is starting to show that perhaps that doesn't do, let me put it another way, that it may be doing more harm than good to do what we call debriefing immediately after an event. The research is showing that debriefing is supposed to be, since I only have one time to talk to this victim, debriefing suggests that I ask the victim to sort of revisit the event and help them think about it in a different way. But what I'm doing is making them go back and relive the event, think about it, tell me about it, that sort of thing. And it's now pretty well believed that that does more harm than good. Making them go back and think about the event immediately after the event to help them think about it in a different way actually just reinforces the neural networks that are starting to form, as well as the chemistry that's in the body, et cetera. And the alternative is called psychological first aid, or PFA. And as long ago as about 20 years ago, the World Health Organization actually stopped using agencies that were using debriefing. And so this controversy has been going on for quite a while. And here in the United States, we actually started facing it after 9/11. And now just about every response agency, Red Cross, National Organization of Victims Assistance, even the CISM approach, has been modified as far as the way they deal with victims to do more of the psychological first aid approach as opposed to debriefing. And just to wrap this up, psychological first aid, its basic premise is, instead of making you go back and think about the event, our premise is for psychological first aid is, you've been through a tough situation, and we're going to talk to you about how you're going to survive it. So the focus is on coping mechanisms, on linkages to support agencies, looking ahead rather than looking behind. Now, of course, if you're going to do long-term therapy for trauma, you've got to go back and revisit. But if you only have one shot with the victim immediately after the event, the research is now supporting that you do psychological first aid as opposed to debriefing. Did I make that clear enough?
It's clear to me.
Okay, good.
I would like clarification on one thing, if
sure.
you would. When we say, or when you say immediately, what are we talking? Are we talking within minutes, within hours, days? Well, what is considered to be an immediate?
Usually we're talking within the first 48 hours, within the first 2 days. Sometimes that can get stretched to 3 or 4, depending on if you're able to even get to the victim, depending on the event. But we're certainly talking within the first few days. Anything longer than that, you don't tend to use a one-shot approach. You tend to use a longer-term intervention.
Yeah. Now, we've had over recent years some of these terrible events or incidents at schools, school shootings, and so forth. And in many, if not all, cases that I recall, there have been counselors brought in to talk to the students, faculty, what have you. Are these cases generally, it seems to me they are fairly quick. Would these be considered immediate interventions?
Yes, they would. Because they usually bring them in the next day and the day after that. And remember that when you have grief counselors coming into a school, and that's usually what they call them, although they're probably mental health practitioners of a variety of ways. When you have them coming in, part of what they're doing is not only working with the client and helping the client to look forward rather than back, but they're also assessing that person to see if that person may need more support than just the one intervention. You know, only about 30% of people who experience a trauma actually eventually get a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. So that means that the vast majority of people will actually come through this without any further counseling support. And so one of the things that those grief counselors do is they're making assessments to see, is someone high risk? Is someone reacting a little more strongly, a little more vulnerable to this situation than the others? And so they're doing a little bit of screening at the same time.
Dwayne, let me. I'll let Kim. I'll let you in here in a second. I've just raised another question.
Sure.
Now, when we're talking about events, obviously the shooting situations and those types of things, does an event have to involve a death, or can it be just a traumatic experience? For example, the young child, a 5 or 6 year old, that disappears at the mall shopping with the parents, and all of a sudden the child is gone and it can't be found. Would there be an intervention in that situation, or does it have to involve an actual death?
It does not have to involve a death. Now, what you described with the child missing, and like we talked about on the previous show, is the unique thing about missing people or missing children is that the event is not over as long as they are missing. So particularly as immediately after a child goes missing, the parent's last thought is about getting support for themselves. And all of the energy is put into finding the child. Because, you know, the statistics say finding them, the quicker you find them, the better chance of finding them alive. So all of the energy is put into that. And there's, when you're doing either debriefing or psychological first aid, what you're doing is you're talking about an event that's over and done. So it's not really appropriate to use either of those for something that's still pending or still going on. A parent may want to get some support counseling later on, but still, you're not going to look at the event like it's over until they either know that the child has been returned, or the child is deceased, or they make that determination for themselves.
So immediately after the event, it could be where a child, say, goes missing and is found deceased 3 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
Once that the body has been found, and then the parent is counseled, that would be considered immediate because it was immediate after the finding of the body.
Yeah.
As opposed to immediately after the disappearance.
Yeah, it would be after finding the body. And I've actually been in that situation where I've been with the parent when the child's body has been found, and doing that immediate intervention at that point. Of course, I'm not saying the minute that they find the body, but within a few hours, helping that person to focus on, again, the best way I can describe it is focus ahead rather than behind. You do have to give a person a period of time to grieve, but as far as the trauma of the event, that's what you're really trying to work with when you're talking about debriefing or psychological first aid.
Okay, Kim.
Yes. Well, you kind of answered the question I had, but I have another one here. So I just want to make sure I understand this okay. Without the psychological first aid, is there more of a chance to develop PTSD?
According to the theory, yes. Now, what I do have to tell you is there have been significant amount of studies now done on debriefing, and then whether it affects a person later developing PTSD. And now pretty much most of the studies are saying debriefing really does nothing as far as a person developing it. The same percentage of people still seem to develop PTSD afterwards. There has not, that I have seen, there has not been the same kinds of studies done yet with PFA, with psychological first aid. So I can't say whether it does or doesn't, but certainly that is the theory. And once you understand how the brain works and how the brain controls the chemicals in the body as far as cortisol levels and that sort of thing, certainly
mm-hmm.
by focusing on the future, talking about coping mechanisms and that sort of thing, you're reactivating the cerebral cortex, which actually kind of goes blank when you're in fight, flight, freeze. And so you're reactivating the cerebral cortex, which helps the person to access their left frontal lobe where their coping mechanisms are supposedly stored. Their ability to modulate their anger and fear is supposed to be controlled from the left frontal lobe. So if you look at the anatomy, it would make sense that, yes, this does help. But I got to say, I have not seen research that says yes or no yet.
Okay. As far as debriefing in adults versus children, there must be quite a vast difference in how you go about doing it, especially if you're talking, I would think anyways, especially if you're talking within the first 48 hours, because, for obvious reasons, but because an adult, you know, may have to deal with, I guess, if you have to deal with the funeral and the planning and the church and the service and everything else, it kind of gives an adult something to do immediately after the death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But and that almost seems to me like it helps a bit. But then it's after everything is said and done for the adult, then you're just like, okay, now it's the next day after everything's over, and where do I go now? That's when you have that drop.
In fact, you're absolutely right. The research is now saying that most people go into what is known as dissociation immediately after a traumatic event, and that means that they kind of separate from the event for a period of time so they can kind of get themselves ready to deal with it. So if you debrief a person while they're in dissociation, you're making them give up that dissociation and go back and revisit the event. So that's another argument against debriefing, where if I'm in dissociation to kind of separate from it and you work with me with psychological first aid, all you're talking to me about are things that I can do tomorrow and what my coping skills are and how to look at other people and compare myself to other people and that sort of thing. So I'm not going back and looking at the event. So you're absolutely right. That's a lot of people call that distraction, and certainly it is. But more the research is saying we need that period of dissociating from the event for a period of time before we start to then go back and deal with it. Now, with children, there's several things that's different about children. First of all, the thing that traumatizes is different. In other words, well, here's a good example. After 9/11, I did a lot of corporations called and said, come talk to our employees. We don't know what they need, kind of thing. And so we did a lot of educating employees as to how trauma works and how they might react to this and whatever. And whenever it was a young group that we knew had young children, we would ask things like, so how are your kids doing? And most of the parents would say, oh, they're fine. They don't know. They don't understand, 9/11. They don't understand the bombing of the war or the terrorist attack. And we'd have to actually go through a litany of saying, well, okay, so what did you do that day? Here in D.C., literally the city shut down because the Pentagon was hit. So what did you do that day? Well, they sent me home early. Okay, how often do you come home early? Oh, never. I usually work late. Okay, and when you got home, what did you do? Watch TV. How often do you watch TV during the day? Oh, never. And when you were watching the TV, how were you? I was emotional. Look at what I was looking at. I was emotional. What was your four-year-old doing? Well, she was being really clingy. She would hold on to me, and I'd have to kind of push her away, and she'd cling again, and I'd push her away. But eventually, she was okay. She went off and played by herself. The child wasn't traumatized by the event of 9/11. That child was having a reaction to the way daddy was behaving because he was breaking all the rules. And when she needed some reassurance, clinging, the reaction she got was he kind of pushed her away. He wasn't realizing she was asking for help. She was asking for clarity at that point. So what I'm saying here is, children are traumatized by much different things than adults, and you have to understand what traumatizes them before you can even begin to work with their trauma. So in that case, she's traumatized by her caregiver's behavior and their emotional response, not by the event. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, sure.
And so kids are usually traumatized when something they think should be safe is no longer safe in their perception. Well, you know, Daddy should have been safe, but Daddy's acting really strange. There's something wrong with Daddy. And when I'm trying to find out what's wrong with Daddy and get some reassurance, Daddy pushed me away. So something that was supposed to be safe suddenly was no longer safe. I'm not saying that child was traumatized by Daddy, but certainly that could have been the source of trauma for her.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's where you have to start working, not with 9/11, for working with that child. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, children are very affected of what they see their parents, how they see their parents acting, I think, and that scares them too.
Right. You can actually traumatize an infant, and the infant is traumatized by its recognition that mom's body's not doing what it's supposed to. If mom's heart rate is up, if mom's respiration is up, if, you know, when we traumatized, our sweat actually smells a little different and tastes a little different, and baby, you know, that's what baby uses to identify primary caregiver. And when those things are wrong, something's wrong. And, you know, maybe everybody else in the family can pick that child up, but when mama tries to, baby gets real fussy because there's something wrong with mama. So that would be the source of trauma, not whatever it was that traumatized mom. Baby doesn't know what that was. Yeah. So you got to, that's the first thing with kids. And then the other thing with kids is language. Children don't necessarily have the language to express what they're experiencing. And so very often you have to do nonverbal kinds of things to allow them to express themselves. The group that Denny referred to that I was talking to yesterday, many of them were actually child advocates and child protection folk. So what they work with all the time is, you know, abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, whatever, of children. And again, the child looks more at who is doing the abuse rather than the actual act itself, because the person doing the abuse is supposed to be safe, and they're not safe anymore. And working with those kids, very often they can't verbalize what's gone on. They can't find the words to go with it, so you have to find other ways to help them express it.
Okay. Well, I just can't... I'm telling you, when Denny and I were talking earlier about when your child goes missing for the first time, I remember when my daughter, when she was younger, and I swear I wanted it like tired to me, because she would just become mesmerized by something. When I thought she was right next to me, she'd toddle on off, and I would turn around and she wasn't there. And that feeling you get is so, it just, the pit of your stomach drops out. And I just can't imagine what it's like. And of course, then I see her and everything's wonderful. And I, you know, you want to, you know, because they've just scared the death out of you. But I can't imagine what it's like for that parent to have that sinking feeling, and but it doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
It continues for hours after that, and days and weeks. You know, imagine, I just can't hardly get over that. I just wanted to say that. Denny?
Yes.
What do you think? What do you have?
I got a couple more questions here for Dwayne, if I can.
Yes, please do.
Dwayne, we know that, we touched on this a little bit the last show, the feelings of guilt. Most parents, you know, if I only wouldn't have allowed the child to go to the swimming pool or to the playground, maybe none of this would have happened. And that, I think you said, was natural. People are going to question whether they could have done something different or should have.
Absolutely.
But periodically, thankfully, it's very rare, but you hear these horror stories on the news that a young child, in some cases an infant, was found dead after being locked in a hot car with the windows up for 4 hours while the mother was in the bar having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here, clearly, there should be some guilt. I mean, would you ever get involved counseling or trying to help someone like that who had probably is going to be charged with a crime? And would you handle them differently than you would handle the regular, the normal situation?
That's a really loaded question, Danny.
It is. It is. Good job, Danny.
Would I ever help someone who clearly was responsible for not only the death, but one that is clearly negligence or even perhaps purposeful? Mm-hmm. It would depend on what was it they wanted help with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I tend to believe that people who are guilty of infanticide, in other words, they kill an infant, even through neglect, there's something missing there anyhow. Either there's already some kind of a mental health disorder going on, or there was something missing in their upbringing or their knowledge of parenting, or there's something missing there. It would depend on what was it they were trying to accomplish by counseling. I mean, if they're having, I can't even come up with an example. I don't think I can't say blatantly no. I can't say blatantly yes. It would depend. I'd have to kind of hear, well, why do you want counseling? What do you want it for? You know, some folks would want to get into counseling right away to maybe reduce the sentence or something. I don't want to be a part of something like that, certainly.
Right. Excuse me, Dwayne. Let me just interrupt for a second. We got a caller on the line. Let me take the call now. We'll get back to your answer.
Sure.
Hello.
Caller from 719. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
This is Melody. How are you?
Hi, Mel.
Hi, Melody.
How are you guys? Okay.
Oh,
great.
We're doing wonderful. It's so good to hear you.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to share some things that I thought might help. I just finished listening to your last program with Dwayne on there. And my son was murdered, and we have a cover-up going on. But talking about the grief and the feeling like, you know, you could have done something differently, one of the first things I told myself was we cannot could have, would have, should have.
Mm-hmm.
It'll tear you up. You have to forgive yourself as well as others. It'll eat you up if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
The truth will keep you balanced. You have to think straight. You just continually, if you talk to yourself. And one of the other ladies was on last time. Yes, we are treated like lepers. And it's wise for us to be smart who we share our story with and when. Because sometimes somebody might not be ready to hear such a thing. You know, it is helpful, though, to discuss it with people because it's part of our life. And people
right.
are just going about their life in a normal manner of, you know, they have their career, the kids go to school, they come home, they go to the movies, they do this, you know, oh, my God, my kid was murdered or my kid's missing.
Mm-hmm.
They have no idea the trauma. You just threw them into orbit with what you've said. They have
mm-hmm.
no idea how to relate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always, this has helped me to remember, there's always somebody who's had something worse happen in their life. Help keep it in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can reach out to somebody else, I know you said that, and that is true. Reach out to somebody else and make a difference because you can. When we buried my son, that's what we said at the funeral, make a difference. In somebody else's life, because you can. They're not here anymore. We are. And don't be consumed with the trauma. We got to. It's a balancing act. We have to keep things in perspective. And pity parties don't help. And believe me, I've been having one, and it doesn't help. We got to get up one day at a time, just one day at mm-hmm. a time. And some days you're going to be strong, and some days you're going to just. Leave me alone. I want to go crawl in a hole. But you have to go through it. I have not read Dwayne's book, but I'm interested, and I wanted to share. I just picked up a book at the library by Jerry White, and it's called I Will Not Be Broken. And I've only read not even the first chapter, and it's already helped me immensely. And another thing that's really helped me, and this is the last thing I'll share, is limit the negative information you take in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get on Facebook and I don't understand how all that works, but people will send me stuff. Do you want to be, you know, with this missing persons, with this program, and I can't do it. I'm doing enough dealing with my own, trying to reach out to other people. So, and you watch the news, it's negative. It pulls me down. That's something I've learned. It pulls my strength away from me. So rather than go into that, you know, on a strong day, yeah, I can do it. But be careful. You got to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I just wanted to share that. I hope that's helpful to anybody listening. And thank you guys for your show, because
thanks for calling,
like you,
Melody.
It's people like you that help us to keep going. Thank you.
Thanks, Mel.
Take care, you guys.
Thank you, Melody. You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Well,
she makes some very good points. And some of those are about your environment, and she made an excellent point about news. I got to tell you, because of the work I do, I'd never read a newspaper. I'll watch the 11 o'clock news because it's kind of like news bites, but I get enough of it. I don't need to take on all the news. You know, I don't need to take on all the world's problems. I have enough information to know what's going on in the world, but I don't need the details. And watching shows like CSI or those kinds of shows, you know, they just don't work for me. They just, you know, they all have happy endings, you know, and that's not the way the world is. So, but she's right, and you got to watch who you surround yourself with. If you've got people who are around you who are just always negative and always looking at the negative, that's not going to help you as you're trying to get through grief or trauma. And so she makes some very good points there, and being able to reach out to somebody who gets it, who understands, who maybe has been there, can be the most support you can find.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
Dwayne, can I just jump in quick and go to my second question I had?
Sure.
We addressed the first one. This one I don't think is quite as loaded as the first one. Melody, the caller we just had, we profiled her case or her son's case. In fact, it was our opening show. But Melody and other, mostly mothers we're dealing with, who have lost children, and primarily where the deaths have been classified as suicide or accident, there's reason to believe there may have been a homicide. Mm-hmm. And what I hear when I'm talking to these folks is that because they were in a state of shock initially when they first got the news that their son or daughter was found dead, that they're not thinking clearly.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to deal with the news and then, you know, what to do next, arrangements and so on and so forth. And they don't realize until later, until days or maybe even weeks have passed, when they start thinking more clearly, or perhaps they're contacted by friends of the deceased or classmates or that type of thing, and are then given information that they weren't aware of or didn't remember hearing in that first few hours or first couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, the things that should have been addressed immediately were not.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes then it's the investigation's already been closed out and you can't get it reopened with new information and so forth. I don't know if there's any way to overcome that. I mean, people are going to be in shock. What is the best chance is having for the parent, next of kin of the deceased, would be to have hopefully somebody supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it would be a professional counselor, but a family member perhaps, or a neighbor or a friend.
Yeah.
You know, rather than trying to do everything alone, maybe have somebody who's thinking more clearly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Involved.
And that's very true. And even with death notifications, which I've done on a couple of occasions, I if at all possible, will not do a death notification unless there's somebody there with the person I'm giving the notification to. It is because of what happens in your body, and I keep talking about cortisol, but it really is a hormone that's the most active in trauma, it actually floods your hippocampus, which is your short-term memory center. And so there's going to be stuff you're not going to remember. And in fact, they say only about 40% of the information people try to give you when you are in a traumatic state actually gets in. So it's important, and I would suggest that you have somebody with you at all times, and that that person be either extended family or a friend that is close enough to the family that they not only know you, but they know your kids. They know how your kids behaved and whatever. And not that they are going to speak for you, but that they can speak to you and say, you know what, they're saying this is, for example, let's say, they're saying this is suicide, and I know he wouldn't have done that, would he? And that gets me started thinking and going, well, no, I need to talk to that policeman or whatever. So having somebody who, it wouldn't be a counselor, it wouldn't be even clergy if the clergy doesn't know the family. It would be have to be either an extended family member like a grandparent. Grandparents, it is amazing to me when I work with families with missing children, the role that grandparents play, because they're not only seeing this happen to their grandchild, but they're seeing it happening to their child as well. And yet they tend to be the ones who, in many cases, hold it all together. And they're the ones that have the rational frame of reference very often. Sometimes the brother or sister of the parent, or an aunt or an uncle, someone that's not definitely in the nuclear family there, but certainly close enough that they know all of the players and they can speak from experience about the victim or whatever has happened here. So yes, absolutely. People should have someone with them that is a little bit more detached, but still knows the family very well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree 100%, because it's amazing how much you don't take in when mm-hmm. you're in that situation. You just don't, like 40%. I didn't know about the percentage on it, but I figured it was less than 50.
You know, in the bio that you read, you mentioned that one of the things that I do is through the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing, actually sit at the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner and sit with folks who are identifying loved ones. One of the things that I always recommend is that the person never come in alone, that they come with somebody, because we're going to give them a lot of information about what's to do next and why things are happening the way they are. And they're only getting, like I said, about 40% of it. So if you got two people there, even if they're the both parents, hopefully that between them, one gets 40% and the other one gets 40%, maybe you've got 60% now, you know? But if you're there by yourself, you're going to miss more information than you're going to hear.
Okay, before we move on, I just want to say we had a Skype call. I had twice a 111 area code, and both times the caller dropped off, so I was just in the process of getting to you, so if you did have a question and you call back, I'll certainly put you on right away. So you're invited, if you care to ring back in, and we'll get you on right away. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt the flow here.
Not at all, not at all.
Denny, do you have another question?
I do, but I'll let you go. I don't want to be accused of show hogging.
Well,
oh, I'm the one that's doing that. You don't have to worry about me.
Well, mine, I was kind of like really kind of towards the end, but I'll go ahead with it. There are the issues of resiliency and post-traumatic growth. Yeah. And we were talking about the debriefing and the PFA, and I'm just wondering what is that? Resiliency and post-traumatic growth.
Okay.
Is that have to do with spiritualism, how spiritual you are? What, you know, because that all plays a part in the trauma too.
Oh, absolutely. But those are two really big different subjects. But absolutely, if you don't deal with a person's spirituality who has been traumatized, you're missing a big chunk of what's happening. And I'll just make one more statement on that and then move to the other. With spirituality is many things to many people, but your core beliefs, what you believe about the world, your place in the world, all of that falls under spirituality. A trauma makes you question and in some cases abandon your core beliefs. If you believe that bad things don't happen to good people and nothing horrible will ever happen to my family, and then something does, you have to let go of those beliefs. So there's always a spiritual aspect to trauma. Over to resiliency. Depends on the definition you want to follow, but most, if you look up resiliency, you're going to get some kind of definition like the ability to return to normal functioning. And so how resilient you are, how quickly you can return to normal functioning is an indication of how resilient you are. Well, I got to tell you, I do not buy that definition. So I have a Bowersism. That's mine. I believe after a trauma, you never go back to normal. Normal doesn't exist anymore. Your world has changed. Your worldview has changed. And so I believe that resiliency is the ability to create a new normal and then function within that new normal. Now, that's a little harder than just saying, okay, you're going to get back to normal functioning, because you have to come up with a whole new belief about the world and then function within that. The Charles Figley, who's kind of a big name in traumatology, says that people tend to be one of two things if they're resilient. They're either trait-based, which means it's in their character to be resilient. They don't need anything outside of themselves. Or they're situationally resilient, which means certain situations I will come back to normal functioning, but not every situation. And that's where most of us fall. Most of us can handle some stuff, but not everything. And so one of the keys to resiliency is your ability to be adaptable. And so if you live very rigidly, if you've got a rigid set of rules, and you live kind of black and white, this is good, this is bad, there's no gray area, no wiggle room, you tend to have less resiliency in a situation of crisis than a person who has looser boundaries, a grayer sense of, you know, that sees more gray space between the black and the white, tend to have more resiliency. In fact, I just read about a study where they showed pictures of traumatic pictures to a group of people, and what they found was the ones who called themselves conservative had more difficulty dealing with the pictures and the aftermath of the pictures than those who called themselves liberal. So the idea of being adaptable and the rigidity of your thinking plays a lot in resiliency and being able to come back to functioning. Post-traumatic growth is a form of resiliency, but it's a form of resiliency where the person is able to say, they're able to find a positive value out of this negative event. A person who says, I never want to go through something like that again, but it pulled my family closer together, or I found more strength than I thought I had, or something like that. I find something positive out of it. These folks who create nonprofits after their child goes missing, they create a nonprofit to help other parents of missing children. That's their post-traumatic growth. They're trying to give the event some value, some meaning, something positive to come out of this horrible thing that I've experienced, and maybe I can help someone else not have to experience it in the same way I did. And so you see that a lot in any kind of trauma. People, you know, women who have been raped and go to a rape center and then become a buddy to someone who has more recently been raped, or homeless shelters where they set up a structure to reach back. Well, think about your 12-step programs, sponsoring, reaching back and helping someone else. It's all basically the same idea that I want some good to come out of whatever the negative was that brought me to this point.
And kind of like Melody was saying, too, you know, about helping others.
Absolutely.
Let that be your stepping stone to helping others.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. And even if you ask people who have been through a traumatic event and now they're doing something, they've created a nonprofit or whatever, and you ask them, so why are you spending all this time helping other people? They kind of look at you like you've gone crazy because they say, no, you missed the point. This is part of my recovery. This is what I have to do to give this event some meaning. I'm doing this really for me so I get better. It may be helping other people, but the real deal here is it's giving my son or daughter's death or whatever some value, some meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And
some meaning.
And it really is a good indicator that the person is, number one, resilient, and number two, recovering. And I'm using the ing on that because recovery is a long, long process. I'm not sure you ever totally recover, quite honestly. I think you're always kind of working toward it. You get better. I don't know that you ever get well, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So. I can see where that would be the truth on that. Interesting. Well, I like to think I'm an adaptable person, so hopefully.
Yeah.
So, Denny.
Yes.
You're next.
So, okay. Denny, are you adaptable?
Are you adaptable,
so.
Denny?
I think so.
Good.
We talked a little bit last year, too, about support groups.
Mm-hmm.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you said that they could serve a valuable role, and you were in favor of support groups.
Mm-hmm.
There was, however, a situation I encountered personally. And I'll just run this by you and see what you think of this scenario. A lady whose daughter had been killed wanted to start a support group in our local area, and she did. And she named the group after her daughter,
mm-hmm.
which was no one had any problem with that. And got especially at first, maybe 8 or 10 people who had lost children to attend meetings, and it got unfortunate. I think it was unfortunate. Over a few weeks, in other words, you could get space for your support group at churches,
mm-hmm.
the basements of churches. I think a library even offered a room one night a week, and so on. But the lady who had set this up wanted almost a business. I didn't know, she wanted to rent space and have a sign out, you know, with the name of the group on it and so forth. And for that, she needed money,
mm-hmm.
to pay the rent and whatever else was involved. And got more into fundraising and that type of thing, and the meetings turned into almost exclusively discussions of her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the other attendees felt that they weren't getting a chance to express their feelings
right.
And ask questions. And then probably the last straw for some of the people was when the lady said that unless more money came in, she was going to have to give up the office that she had rented. And so she suggested for a fundraiser a jello wrestling exhibition or something along those lines. And that's when most of the people bailed out. And we were under the impression that the main impetus behind this thing was because she so much wanted something with her daughter's name attached and
mm-hmm.
And so forth, that maybe that got the better of her judgment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Did you ever hear of such things as that, where somebody tries to start with a good intention?
Absolutely.
But
if you're going to join a support group, I have a strong suggestion that you find out, has the facilitator experienced the same thing, and that shouldn't disqualify them. In fact, that actually makes them probably a good facilitator. But the second question should be, have you taken a course in group facilitation? You know, non-mental health professionals can take a simple course, there's many of them out there, on how to run a group. And that teaches you how not to make the group all about you, and how you run a group and make sure that it is for everyone, not just about you and about your situation. You know, mental health folk get into that all the time. We have to be real careful that we don't get into our own stuff when we're trying to work with a client that has a similar history than us. But we're trained to do that. And if we do get into it, it's called unethical, and you can actually lose your license for it. Call them a civilian, when a non-mental health professional is running a group, they should, for their own sake, take and some of these classes are like, you know, 2 weeks, a couple of evenings for 2 weeks or whatever. They just give you the basis of how to facilitate a peer support group, and they should be co-led so that it's not all run by one person, so that if one person's kind of getting into their own stuff, the other one can kind of distract the group and take them somewhere else. So if you're looking for a support group, anybody that's listening out there, kind of think of those things. Is it run by someone who has mental health experience or not? Is it someone who has similar experience to the kind of group? In other words, they've lost someone like the group is presenting. And if so, have they taken a class and are they co-facilitating with someone else? Otherwise, you may find yourself in that situation. And you know, I don't put those folks down because she's working through her grief. She's just kind of pulled all these other people into it, and they thought they were going to be working through theirs. She was kind of building a memorial. You know, some folks' memorial is a gravestone. Some is you know, a group of pictures on their piano. Hers was going to be this office with her daughter's name on it. And I can get it. I can understand it. But that wasn't helpful to the other people.
Yeah, and it was unfortunate, but the whole thing, I finally pulled it up because nobody came anymore.
Sure.
So the whole purpose got defeated over that, which is unfortunate. Now you say there are several of these courses that people could take to get the basics if they're going to start.
If it's related to death, I would suggest folks call their local hospice. One of the things that hospices have to do by their charter, to be chartered, a hospice has to be a center of information on grief and grief support. And they have to provide that information to the community, whether the community used their services or not. So I would contact my local hospice, find out if they're aware of any group facilitation classes, or what does that hospice themselves do to make a person reputable or to train a person to lead their groups, and can I take that class before I run my own group? I think AARP even has, I know at one time they had folks who would train you on how to lead, because many of the AARP chapters around the country have a support group for widows and widowers, and those folk take a training before they facilitate the group, and they're not mental health folks, they're widows or widowers themselves, and so I think AARP may actually offer one of those classes too. So if you dig a little bit, you'll find them.
That is an excellent idea. I never even thought of that. And it's important to maybe ask those questions, too, when you go to get into a group situation like that. Who's running it? What kind of experience do they have? That kind of thing.
Yep.
Excellent idea.
Dwayne, I don't want to put you on the spot. But,
but here we go.
Oh, yes, he does. Yes,
Well, I ask you now, on occasion when we're scheduling one of our cases to profile, our guest, the spokesperson for the deceased, is going to be on and expresses an interest, would you be willing to come on the show as a panelist or a co-panelist?
Sure. Because I'm not sure what that means, let me just say, certainly I couldn't do any counseling or anything like that. But I could certainly make suggestions or referrals, like I just did about, you know, getting training and that sort of thing, or help answer some questions about what's happening to me. You know, why am I forgetting everything? Those kinds of things. I could certainly help with that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. The general, not specific to that individual, but
sure,
general information.
I'd be honored.
Well, thank you very much. We'll certainly keep that in mind.
Good. Mm-hmm. Oh, that wasn't on the spot. On the spot is asking me, would I counsel someone who actually killed their child? That's putting me on the spot.
Yeah, of course, I never would have asked that question.
I hear you.
We're playing good host, bad host.
Good enough.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Good host, bad host. Oh, my gosh, that's funny.
Some of the people like to hear my laugh, so I'm...
Yes.
I didn't get to hear it the last show, so I'm glad to hear it tonight. Oh, so okay. I'm one of those folks.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Well,
I'm sorry, Kim, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say, before we ring off, before the show ends, did you have any other questions, Denny? Anything else you'd like to add?
Not right now. I've got some other topics, but I'll tell you the truth, a couple of things I'm thinking about really would... we shouldn't start into with only a couple minutes left because they would tend to, we wouldn't do them justice.
Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm thinking too. So I guess we will end the show. And I thank you very much, Duane, for coming on again with us.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
I learn so much every time I talk to you. I've just taken all these notes here, and I got page after page, and it's just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you, Denny.
Thank you, Duane, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thanks.
Appreciate it.
And I do want to say that next Tuesday, October 20th, we will, if you want to join us, we have another good show lineup. We are profiling the case of Sean McMillan. Sean was driven on September 2nd, 2001, Sean McMillan was driven into the parking lot of the Helen Ellis Hospital by Rita Nordmark and her intoxicated brother-in-law, Dan Nordmark, an off-duty corrections officer. It was approximately 2:26 a.m., and a bullet from the drunken officer's gun had just ripped through Sean's brain, destroying everything in its path. Officer Nordmark alleged the wound was self-inflicted. However, the facts prove otherwise. We will be joined by Sean's mother, Michaela, also a private investigator, Vito Colucci Jr., and private investigator, William Cobra Staubs. We will also be posting a YouTube video of Officer Nordmark being questioned by the police in this incident, where in the video you will see him take his Fifth Amendment 600 times. And that's the show for next Tuesday. So thank you, Duane, again, and thank you, Denny, and thank you everyone that joined us tonight, and thank you, Melody, for calling in, and goodbye, and God bless.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Good night.